Coming up Sunday morning at 9 on a new episode of Hometown Heroes, a 94-year-old ex-prisoner of war remembers the day World War II came to the Philippines.
We didn't do anything until we heard some bombs whistling through the air, and here came the bombs. Then all live.
Hear about the close calls that followed, including the way he narrowly avoided the Bataan Death March. That's Hometown Heroes, Sunday morning at 9 on 1560 AM and 97.7 FM KNZR.
Is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you that no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have done and endured incredible things for the sake of our freedom. We want to make sure that our veterans know how much we appreciate it. We want to honor them for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure do learn a lot. Sometimes we're even inspired by their stories. And the story we're going to hear today is a story of survival. 94-year-old Bill Overmeyer of Albuquerque, New Mexico, our guest. For 3.5 of those 94 years, he was a prisoner of war in the Pacific Theater. And he has quite a story to tell. We're going to hear it over the next hour. Let's start out early on, though. You did not grow up initially in New Mexico, Bill. You were from Illinois, farm
yes.
town?
I was near Decatur, Illinois. Well, we had moved to Decatur by the time before we'd left and came to New Mexico, for New Mexico was one of the top places to go if you had tuberculosis. My mother had tuberculosis. I've been through all the schools here. I've graduated engineering degree from the University of New Mexico thanks to the GI Bill. After I came back from overseas.
And it was quite a task to make it home from overseas and to survive everything you went through. So you moved here to Albuquerque when you were 8 years old, finished high school here, were even in college. And I guess it was during those years that you decided to join the National Guard?
I carried newspapers when I was in junior high school, and I was able to buy a Model A Roadster.
Ooh.
For $75. That's pretty darn cheap, I'll tell you. Anyway, when I got to college, well, I didn't have any money for gasoline and miscellaneous expenses, going to a restaurant and so on. So I joined the National Guard. At that time, it was 111th Cavalry. It was a state organization. It had been that way since the time of Roosevelt and the Cuban crisis. I would go once a month, I guess it was, and we'd have a drill downtown in the armory, and then we'd get $19 a month. And that was that wasn't bad money. It wasn't very much, but it helped. And, of course, I was in the Guard when they finally decided, well, we had a fracas overseas, and we better have some help. So they picked on the New Mexico National Guard and said, go down to Fort Bliss and train. So we did.
But before we move on, I'm curious, because you spent, I guess, from age 8, and that would have been to about age 20, even 21, here in Albuquerque. I know what it's like now. I've gotten a taste of it. What was it like back then? Was it a lot different? I know it didn't have as many people. But what were the kinds of things you really enjoyed about Albuquerque back then?
The skiing in the wintertime. We'd have pretty good snows up on the mountains, and we'd go fishing in the summertime. We never did have too much water, but we did have enough water to come down from Colorado and fill up some of our lakes. And it was just a clean town of about a 20,000 population.
20,000?
20,000 people when we came.
A lot more than that now.
Yeah. They had a streetcar going down the main street downtown, but they had discontinued that before we got there. And, of course, we all went to the moving picture shows and saw all of the Errol Flynn and all the favorite movie actors, and it was fun. We enjoyed it.
There wasn't anything called the Pit back then, was there?
No, there was not. No. We belong to what they call the Border Conference, and it was a series of teams from Arizona, Arizona State, Utah, UNM, the Aggies. No, let's see. No, I don't think the Aggies were in it. But there was it was a very competitive football, basketball, and baseball. We enjoyed that as well.
Were you ever involved in any of those sports?
I tried. One time I was, before we went overseas, I said to myself, well, I've always loved football. I remember back in Decatur, Illinois, we lived right across the street from a grade school that had a real nice lawn, and the high school would come and practice every day for football. So I've always loved football. One time I went out for football for the Lobos. It was spring football. They put me in. I weighed about 145 pounds, I do believe. I played defensive end for a couple scrimmages and so on and so forth. Finally, the coach put me head to head against Dutch Niemans, who was a Border Conference, all Border Conference fullback. He weighed 200 plus pounds, and he had the ball, and I was supposed to tackle him. Well, I said, the only way I can get him to come down is to hit him low. So I hit him, bent my head down low, and the darn fool, he kicked me in the head with his thigh on the top of the old leather helmet I had, and I was drunk for 2 hours. I said to myself, Bill, You want to die? You keep playing football. So I quit.
Little did you know what other perils and hazards you were going to face.
Yep.
The old days of Albuquerque, 20,000 people. Wow. So they send you to Fort Bliss. And I imagine before that, you'd had some ambitions, right? You're in engineering school at the University of New Mexico. What were you hoping to do with yourself?
Aeronautical engineer. I wanted to spend 2 years as my basic engineering at UNM and then go to the main airplane manufacturing in Washington, which is Boeing.
Uh-huh.
They had a school to put out the final engineering the last 2 years. That was my goal. Well, I didn't too good in the first couple years, and then came the call for the National Guard, so I had to postpone it.
How did you feel about that at the time? Uncle Sam saying, head to Fort Bliss. Were you nervous that you might be in some dicey situations, or were you excited for an adventure?
Well, we kind of took it because they told us we had to. They'd been paying us for, I don't know, a couple years, and so we felt obligated. And but we had no idea where we were going.
Mm-hmm.
And we never did find out until we got to the ocean and just kept going to the setting sun. Of course, you finally realize you're going west. And how far are you going? We did not know. We got as far as Hawaii, and I got off. I tried my hand at surfing on a surfboard, paddled out into the waves, and turned around, and here came a wave. Well, the wave went right on by, and I tried it again, and the wave went right on by. So I had to paddle all the way back to shore. I got a nice case of prickly heat in my back from the rest of the trip. I wasn't ready, cut out to be a surfer either.
Well, and little did you know that that little corner of the world would be under attack before too long. This was before the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor when you were there.
Yes, it was. Anyway, got back on our ship. We had all of the 1st battalion of our 200th Coast Artillery anti-aircraft on this one boat. And the President Pierce was the name of it. And came to within about a week of Manila. And here came a storm like we have never seen before. It was a typhoon, and it tossed our boat around like it was a feather. I remember looking over the side, and looking down to the water level, and it was at least 40 feet below the bottom of the boat. I said, why didn't the boat roll off into that chasm But we survived, and some of our equipment, our 4-inch guns, were scooting around on the deck, and some of the guys got out there and restrapped them down and saved them. We had them when we landed in Manila.
I imagine that was a pretty big eye-opener for you, because I imagine you never dealt much with the open sea at all, coming from New Mexico, and certainly not a typhoon from that. Were you scared? Were you wondering whether you'd survive it?
Of course we were scared. It was just unbelievable. We just had our fingers crossed that we'd never have to go through that again. Anyway, we landed in Manila. They moved us up to Fort Stotzenberg, which is adjacent to Clark Field, and we attended drill again, close quarter drill. We were very good at that, and it got so darn hot every day we'd go out and then come in at noon, and we'd have to strip off our khakis and put on a new fresh set of, you'd have to crease the pants open to get your leg in them. They had starch in them.
Uh-huh.
And that's the way they treated the uniforms, and we drilled and practiced, and when the first day of war came, well, we were in the north runway of Clark Field, as clear down at the end, and we were dug in. We had our 4 3-inch guns dug in, the M4 director and the stereoscopic height finder. Incidentally, I was the chief of range section of the aiming, you might say, of the 4-inch guns, and that's the M4 director was the brains for the whole thing. Now, this is before radar.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, we discovered that battery A had been issued some radar, and after they hit us there, the first day of war, well, the second day, three planes came in, and they were flying low. The radar told us, we've got 3 boys coming in such and such 1,000 feet, so we matched pointers until we could see them, and then we went visual. They were coming right straight at us. So I turned in. I was on the M4 director. I entered a little correction on the M4 and shortened the target range and the guns going off so the explosions would be in front of them. They'd have to fly through it. We got 2 out of the 3. The best shooting we had during the whole dang war.
And if you hadn't made that adjustment, you might have gone 0-3.
That's right.
And for folks who don't understand what you're talking about, explain this apparatus. When you say the M4, what does that mean, and how does that determine how these guns are going to operate?
I had been sent from Fort Bliss. I had been sent to Fort Monroe, Virginia, prior to us leaving, to the stereoscopic height finder school. Now, a height finder is a carryover of the range finders that ships use on the ships to determine how far the target is. When they fire their big 12-inch guns or whatever, they have to know how far that target is, if it's 1 mile or 3 miles or just what. And stereoscopic height finder vision is, everybody's got it. It's depth perception. Mm-hmm. And what you do is you take a little cross that's in the height finder and hold it even with the target, and then you say, read. You have 4 men on the height finder. They send that information, which is the critical information of all, for the third dimension of anti-aircraft fire, and send it to the M4 director. The M4 director is a box on a tripod, has 4 men around it, and it's about 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet up on a tripod. It's the brains on how far we lead the target with our shot so we can hit the target.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically one of the basic things we learned there at Fort Bliss, of course.
And little did you know, you would only have a short time to operate those kind of weapons. I want to ask you, they pull you out of everything you're doing. They send you this training. Now they send you overseas. We don't have a war yet. I mean, the war's going in Europe, sure, but America is not at war. America hasn't been attacked. Was it starting to sink into you that they must know something's coming? If they're sending me halfway across the world, that something's about to happen? Did you have an inkling?
Yes, we had scuttlebutt. If anybody knows what that is, it's rumors and unconfirmed, and somebody's thought or somebody's imagination. Who knows what it is? But we live on scuttlebutt. We had rumors that Hawaii had been hit. Some of the guys said, yeah, well, we're going to fight them, but it'll take 6 weeks or so, and we'll clean their plow. Well, it didn't take any 6 weeks, and it took much longer, and it was everything we could do to survive. But the whole darn thing had to do with our forces in Washington, D.C., our brains, resolving a conflict with Japan. And this had been going on for several years. We were sending scrap metal, selling scrap metal to Japan. Japan had ambitions. They had beaten the Russians at a naval conflict, and they were confident that they could get what they wanted. They needed oil. They needed steel. They needed knowledge. They'd sent their military men to the United States, and the United States taught them how to fight a war.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no kidding. That's what happened at Pearl Harbor. Guess what? They used that same lecture to bomb Pearl Harbor. So we knew that things were going to change.
And a lot of people don't realize that war ensued simultaneously in the Philippines when it hit Pearl Harbor, that you guys were under attack basically the same day, right?
That's correct.
Clark Field was hit that same day, although...
It was December the 8th, but it was after the Asiatic Pacific line.
The international date line.
Right.
So it's December 8th in the Philippines, December 7th in Hawaii, but it's the same day you guys are hit.
Roughly 8 hours after Pearl Harbor was hit.
Well, we need to take a break, but we'll talk more about that when we come back. You've heard a lot about Pearl Harbor, but what about the first day of war in the Philippines? And what kind of conditions would Bill have to endure as supplies dwindled and the Japanese advanced? How did he avoid getting swept up on the Bataan Death March? We'll explore some of those questions when Hometown Heroes continues next after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with 94-year-old ex-prisoner of war Bill Overmeyer of Albuquerque, New Mexico, and exploring the early days of America's involvement in World War II. Bill told us how he was deployed to the Philippines in 1941, how just hours after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, they also attacked Clark Field in the Philippines. The loss of life was not as great, but the number of airplanes destroyed on the ground proved a pretty devastating blow. Bill, what do you remember about the way you experienced that day?
We were there all ready for action, and here came some planes over. We heard some planes. We looked up. We saw some ghosts up there. There was 54 of them. We could count them, and they were flying right overhead. Now, was that our plane? We thought it was Navy, and we didn't do anything until... We heard some bombs whistling through the air, and here came the bombs. Man alive. Anyway, couldn't wait to commence fire, so we took our readings with our height finder, and information to the M4 director, to the guns, fire 4 rounds each. That'd be 16 rounds. I gave the order to do that. Well, they fired. The darn things went off about 1,000 feet below the airplanes. After 9 months of training and teaching how to shoot at a target of an airplane, we got into action and we found out that our fuses were World War I fuses, powder-trained fuses. believe it or not. They sent us right into the teeth of the enemy with unprepared. Incidentally, we had World War One helmets, steel helmets. We had World War One Springfield rifles, bolt action, five shots, and how many more things I can't even think of. We thought we had some pretty nice guns, but they did shoot out pretty fast, about the same velocity as a rifle did. And we thought we knew everything there was to know, but we got an education.
Well, and that's what I'm curious to know, what that felt like that day. Because here you've been preparing for it. You know there's a possibility. Then when war's actually there, it's on your doorstep, it's right in your face, and you're firing at the enemy, and the enemy's bombing you. Did that change anything for you emotionally, mentally? Do you remember what that was like?
It filled us with despair. After the bombers dropped, dive bombers came in, and they started strafing and shooting up different areas. Their main targets were the airport, Clark Field, and the buildings, and several or quite a few of our soldiers were killed in the mess hall and in the buildings and so forth. But we were out in the open in a dug-in trench. Incidentally, anybody that joins the Army or the military ought to learn how to dig a hole in the ground, because that's the safest place you can be. Absolutely. Well, anyway, these dive bombers were coming around strafing, and we had two machine guns in our battery, and one of the guys that was a football player from Texas Tech was on my staff, my range staff. He was up on top shooting at the planes with his little handheld machine gun, but he didn't hit anything. We were all shooting with our rifles, or some guys were shooting with their pistols, but we didn't shoot any other planes down until the second day.
The second day is when you described that action where your adjustment led to two Japanese planes being shot down. How long did that rage on at Clark Field before you had to get out of there?
We were not at Clark Field much longer. A matter of days, in fact. They took our Battery B and they took half of our men away from us and sent them down to Manila. Now, Manila had 3-inch guns in wooden boxes, and they were stored in cosmoline. It maintains the integrity of the gun and the equipment and everything else that you're using. So they used those men that they took from us and sent them down. They cleaned the cosmoline. They got some native people to give them help because they were a little shorthanded. And they got set up, and they developed into another anti-aircraft unit. They called them the 515th.
But you stayed behind when they left, or you went with them?
We stayed there at Clark Field another day or so, I guess. Then they moved us out and said, we're moving to Bataan. Well, what's Bataan? Bataan is a peninsula hanging off of the bottom of the main island of Luzon. We went south, and we set up for a day or so up at a main bridge at a big river that was just before you get into Bataan. It was a key bridge to allow soldiers from all over the Luzon and the Philippine Islands. They converged at that area roughly and then settled and retreated back into Bataan to make a stand against the Japanese. We had thousands of soldiers making that retreat, and they had to go over this river. Mm-hmm. And we knew the Japs were going to want to blow it up.
The bridge up so you couldn't cross the river.
Sure. So we protected it.
You protected the bridge with your guns, and folks, of course, are familiar, I think, with the Bataan Death March and those retreating American forces who were forced into that brutal, brutal march. And you know a lot of those Death March survivors because you're part of the same group, that fought on Bataan. But you avoided the Death March.
May I say that the reason for that is I was on Bataan for several months, and about all we did was watch Photo Joe come over, and he'd be way beyond our range. We couldn't reach him. In fact, some of the days were so moist that we couldn't even see him.
And when you say Photo Joe, that's a Japanese reconnaissance plane taking photos of American forces?
Exactly.
All right.
And we had a man on our unit, his name was Gachapin. He was an Indian from New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And we'd say, where is he, Gotchbean? Oh, and he'd look over, and his black eyes would roll over. There he is, with match pointers. We can't see him. Oh, yeah, there he is. Well, we couldn't shoot. All we did is wish he'd get a little closer so we could shoot. So we just sat there and waited. We were set up in a banana grove on Bataan, waiting for action. Come closer and we'll shoot at him. Sure enough, they didn't do it. Finally, one day, right the day before Bataan fell, I was walking someplace in the banana grove with a friend of mine from here. We looked up. Gosh, there's a plane. Well, he's got his motor off. He's coasting down. And I could have thrown a rock at him. If I'd had my rifle, I could have shot him and got him. My rifle was back where I left. Mm-hmm. And you shouldn't do that. You should never lose your rifle. And my buddy, he'd done the same thing. So this plane dropped a bomb. And we hit the ground. And the bomb went off on the other side of my friend. And he got a terrible shrapnel in his leg. They hauled him off to the hospital. He had malaria already. He never made it. Mm. His dad was a dentist here in Albuquerque.
You mentioned Bataan falling, and I've heard a lot of stories of the lead-up to that from different survivors that I've talked to where they mentioned things like you said, that the provisions were World War I era defenses, guns. They were low on ammunition. And then the food supply, there was a shortage of food, didn't have a whole lot to eat. Were you guys starting to experience some of that?
Yes, we were. We were down to half rations, and then they got us down to quarter rations. We found out, I didn't know why we didn't have any food. I found out that when the trucks left Clark Field to retreat to Bataan, they forgot to get the food.
Wow.
We had food stores galore at Clark Field, and the Japs got to use them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's real admirable. Somebody's, it wasn't our responsibility, but I don't know whose it was. But anyway, we had a crew out that would go for game. First, we ate carabao. It was a form of steak. We ate horse meat. The Philippine scouts were a cavalry unit before
right.
we ever got there. Well, we got to eat their horses.
Wow. Well, desperate times, desperate measures.
I ate monkey meat.
Mm-hmm.
I ate iguana.
This is all before you were a prisoner?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, before we got on our way to Bataan.
Uh-huh.
Or after. Same thing, basically. Anyway, we were eating monkey meat, and rice ration was down to something like a quarter of a pound per day or something like that. And we started losing weight. And when we got to Bataan, we were set up in a banana grove, and we used to eat the bananas. They were about 4 inches long,
mm-hmm.
and they were sweeter than pineapple. Boy, they were good. But I've never eaten an American banana because they're nothing like those.
Can't compare to those ones all those years ago, huh?
No way.
Had you heard at this point, as Bataan's about to fall, you're realizing you're in another desperate situation, did you guys hear at the time what MacArthur had done and where he had gone? Were you guys aware of it, or did that not come till later?
We knew it day by day, everything. Yeah. We had fondness for Wainwright. He would go up the front lines. He would leave the tunnel in Corregidor and go up and check the units and so forth, so on. And he was more or less in charge of the whole thing. And MacArthur was holed up in the Malinta Tunnel. He never peeped out. We call him Dugout Doug. As
mm-hmm.
Everybody gets nicknames. Anyway, we heard about him getting a call from Washington and having to go to Australia. I don't feel bad about it. I think it was a wise decision, and the system that they used to retake the Philippines and all of the islands and that area were, I think they were the right ones.
Well, and maybe the lens of history has helped you understand that his strategic importance and what ended up happening, it was important for him to be saved. But at the time, I'm sure there was some grumbling among the troops that, here, your leader in this area of the war is bailing out on you.
That's right. Well, we just live from day to day, mainly just standing there waiting for action. It was boring. Really, it was boring. Months after months of just waiting for action. I was smoking. I'd raised my intake from carton, I don't know, a week or so, to two or three cartons a week. Just nothing to do but smoke cigarettes and just look up in the sky. Right after that bomber, drive bomber, dropped that bomb and ruined us, one of our guys, the next day, Bataan surrendered. Well, before that happened, the night before, it was still daylight, and Jack Ellis, who was the commander, he was a first lieutenant, and our captain had been wounded that day. Jack Ellis was a personal friend of mine, and he said, "Bill, go down to headquarters, down the trail, and find out what to do. Our communications are out, our telephones are out, we've been bombed, and they were destroyed, and we don't know what to do." And so I picked up two other guys. One of them was the son of the principal of Albuquerque High School. So we went down this dark trail. We had our guns with us. And about real dark, well, we got down to headquarters, and they were all loading up in trucks and command cars and heading south for the bottom end of Bataan. And I asked, he was a colonel. I said, "What are we supposed to do, Battery B?" He said, "Hell, I don't know what to tell you to do. Use your own damn judgment." So I'd walked all that distance and gotten a negative answer. And so I had to turn around and go right back up the trail. And it turned dark by that time. And shells were coming over from Corregidor. Shells were coming overhead from the Japanese. And they were bombing Corregidor, shelling Corregidor. And we got back up to the battery midnight. The moon was out, bright as day, and we could look over in the bushes over there, and we could just imagine the Japs are over there. And we checked the guns, and the M4 director, the height finder, and everything had been ruined, scuttled, damaged, ruined. The Japs couldn't use it. So we turned around and went right back down the trail. We got down almost to the water's edge and laid down on the ground to take a break. It's daylight. The ground started to shake. Earthquake.
Wow.
The land had the same reception as we had. Negative. We got up and kept walking. And myself and one other guy, one of them that took off and went someplace else. We got down to the water's edge, and there was a boat out there just aimed towards Corregidor. And it had about 30 guys on the deck. It was a flat top motor launch is what it was. And so we waded out and got on the boat, and the boat took off. We got about halfway over to Corregidor. Uh-oh, here comes three dive bombers looking for trouble, and we were trouble. So we took our guns and aimed, and somebody on our boat said, "Put your damn guns down," as if we didn't aim our guns, they wouldn't aim their guns. Well, somebody's kind of foolish. Not very good leadership. So we put our guns down. And I figured, well, I'm right on the stern. And they're going to come. And here came one plane. Peeled off and came down at us. And I thought, well, is he going to drop a bomb? Or is he going to shoot us with a machine gun? If it's a bomb, it's going to get us. If it's a machine gun, well, maybe if I jump in the water and get as deep as I could get, those bullets won't reach me. So that's what I was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So here come the plane, and here come the machine guns. We looked up. Oh, he's not shooting. What's happening? Oh, a PT boat right over there. Had twin 50 caliber guns on the front and twin 50s on the back, and he was shooting at that plane, and that plane chickened out. Pulled away and left us alone. Mm. We got all the way to Corregidor without getting killed.
PT boat saved you.
Saved my life. You bet it did.
Well, and your decision to get on that boat maybe saved your life. Is that a stretch, or am I correct in thinking that if you guys had not found that boat and had been stuck on Bataan, that you would have been swept up in the death march yourself?
Exactly. Of course, we didn't know anything about the death march at that time, but that's exactly what happened. Everybody that was on Bataan that surrendered made the death march. Or if they were sick, like in a hospital or something like that, they used trucks, American trucks, and took them to the camp.
Well, if you hadn't been spared there, it's a good chance you and I wouldn't be talking right now. Of the more than 70,000 prisoners, American and Filipino combined, who made the death march, more than 10,000 were killed. And those who did survive were faced with years in POW camps after the horrific march. Bill Overmyer would spend more than 3 years as a prisoner, but he still had close calls to survive before he was captured. And we're going to explore that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Back to Bill Overmyer's story in a moment. But first, I've got to take a moment to talk about Honor Flight. If you're listening in the Bakersfield area, this coming Tuesday, May 6th, will be the next trip for World War II veterans to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. That's put together by Honor Flight Kern County. One of the newest hubs for Honor Flight is the Central Coast Honor Flight, taking its first trip from San Luis Obispo on May the 13th. Congratulations, guys, for getting it rolling. HonorFlightCCC.org is their website. Wherever you're listening, you can find an Honor Flight group near you. They're all listed at HonorFlight.org. And where I live, in the Fresno area, we just welcomed home 68 World War II veterans, including five lovely ladies, this past week. The weather back east was pretty atrocious. It was a bit of an adventure. The flight was delayed on the way back, but it was so encouraging to see how determined people were to congratulate these heroes. Folks young and old stayed up late to welcome them home at the Fresno Yosemite International Airport. More than 100 active duty sailors from Lemoore Naval Air Station were there in uniform. So many amazing people helped make it all possible, and it really was moving. So I just wanted to take a moment to thank everybody who had a hand in it and make sure that you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to fill out an application wherever they live so we can help them see their memorial in Washington, D.C. Albuquerque, New Mexico is where I had the privilege of sitting down with 94-year-old Bill Overmyer. And when we left off, he'd shared about how he got to the shore at just the right time to catch a boat headed for Corregidor. By doing so, he avoided the Bataan Death March. And I want to get a feel, Bill, for how significant that was. Because, first of all, you're from New Mexico.
And you served with a lot of the guys that ended up on the Death March. And there were more soldiers on the Death March from New Mexico than any other state. Another, you're still involved with XPOW groups and the Bataan Corregidor Survivors Group. So I know you've heard a lot of these Death March survivor stories over the years. In all those times, when you hear the stories of guys that were too weak to walk just being executed on the side of the road, or the starving, the everything that they went through on that march, have you ever sat there and thought, that could have been me? I could have undergone that same thing and wondered whether you would have survived the march?
Exactly. Exactly. That's exactly what I thought of. I belong to an Oasis group here in town, and we have professors and other people, experts, talk about for an hour and a half. And we had one talk by Jack Love, who was in the 200s, and he made the death march. And he made the talk about his experience on the death march. And when he got through, he was crying. It was pitiful. It was unbelievable. Like heads getting cut off with sabers. The main problem was bayonets. Hmm. The Japs used their bayonets to stick guys in the butt if they wanted them to move. Or they killed babies. They killed Filipinos, pregnant women. Oh, you can't believe what all happened. It was just unbelievable.
And that would have been what you had to deal with had you not made it on that boat. And I'm not trying to say that what you went through was a picnic. because I know better than that. So you get to Corregidor. Did you have any idea it would only be a matter of time until you were captured too? Or did you guys believe that you could hold your ground?
Well, I got to Corregidor, but I was only there for a day or so. Mm-hmm. And I walked through Melinda Tunnel, and I saw Wainwright and how terrible he looked with all the pressure and the war and so forth. And they sent us over that night to Fort Hughes, which was another mile or two off of the tip of Corregidor.
Just another little island?
Little island.
So how many people are on this island?
Fort Hughes was another fortified island with 12-inch mortars. And those 12-inch mortars were all facing Manila Bay. And they had been put in and developed right after the Spanish-American War to keep any of the Spanish-American or any other country from bringing in ships to capture Manila.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically all there was on the island that I knew of. They had tunnels that were manufactured out of the rock formations. They had the ammunition in the tunnels, and we ate and we slept in the tunnels, and we existed in the tunnels most of the time.
So your job was to be there and defend that land should the Japanese approach, or to be taking shots at Japanese airplanes, or what were you guys doing there?
Well, they had 3-inch guns, anti-aircraft guns there on Fort Hughes, just like we were used to using. But when we got there, well, they had so many other soldiers and the original soldiers. It's either the 60th or the 59th Regiment that was there on a permanent basis. They were regular army, and they were there full time before the war even started. But they operated the guns, and we didn't have anything to do. All we did is just stand around and watch and look and try to hide. Anyway, this one day we were out on the beach, my buddy and I, Eastern Beach, and here came a formation of Japanese ships, heavy bombers. They were flying high because they had learned that if they flew at a certain elevation, that the 3-inch guns could not reach them. It was due to the fact that we had World War I fuses in our ammunition called powder train fuses. It's the same thing they use for blowing up dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just could not do the job. But anyway, we looked up and saw the planes, and we said, well, they're coming over. They're not going to bomb us. They're going to bomb Corregidor, which is just a couple miles up. After a few minutes, well, they were closer, and bombs had not dropped yet. But I decided, well, you know, why don't we just play safe? And there's a box in the sand. It's a little concrete box. I'd never seen them one like that. I didn't know what it was for. There was no wiring in it or anything else. But it was big enough for two guys to get in. We got in them. And guess what? A bomb hit within 15 feet of that box. It was probably a 500-pounder, and it blew a hole in the sand as deep as a man standing in the bottom and holding his hand up, and his hand would be even with the ground level.
That's a big crater.
It saved our lives.
Well, there are a few of those moments in your story. We've heard a couple of them already, and there's another. As the days went by, and obviously that's a close call that gets your attention, but were you starting to wonder when, not if, you'd be captured? Or tell me how that all unfolded when you finally realized that your future was going to be pretty uncertain as a prisoner of the Japanese.
Well, along with that flight of planes that went over, that was just a tiny bit in the bucket to what Corregidor was receiving. And we were watching every day the bombers going over and bombing Corregidor. And before we'd come over to Fort Hughes, we spent one night in a magazine. And we had, for sleep partners, we had 3, 5, 7, 12-inch ammunition. It was a magazine, what
uh-huh.
it was.
Uh-huh.
And we found that the Japs were also shelling from Bataan, from the tip of Bataan. Now, that was the primary reason that the death march was conducted, is to get the American soldiers away from where Corregidor was shelling back. So they started the death march, and they gave the soldiers the orders to get these guys up. In the first place, they didn't realize how many prisoners there was.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought there were many fewer prisoners, both Filipinos and Americans. But they were amazed at how many there were. We saw all of this going on. One day, we heard an explosion on Corregidor, and we heard a tremendous boom. And I looked over there, and there was a big, one of the shells had blown up one of those magazines, and a big chunk of concrete was flying through the air, hundreds of feet in the air, just slow motion from the explosion, and they had hit this magazine that had all the ammunition in it.
You mean like the one you'd been sleeping in?
Exactly. Exactly. The same thing. Anybody that was even close to that magazine is no longer with us.
Hmm.
And the Japs would shell with high explosive, and then they'd shell some duds, and the duds would penetrate that concrete. Now, a lot of people don't know the facts of Corregidor, but when they were rebuilt Corregidor after the Spanish-American War, they poured a lot of concrete. They didn't have water, so they used seawater. Now, if you know anything about concrete, I've got a degree in concrete, you do not use salt water in concrete. You don't get any strength at all. And instead of 3,000-pound concrete, you're getting 1,500-pound concrete, or maybe 500-pound concrete. The concrete was porous. You just keep shelling at the thing, and eventually it'll poke a hole through it and go inside.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened. Then we were captured. We saw the day that Corregidor surrendered, they had the white flag up. And we said, uh-oh, we're going to get it. And they'll probably come over tonight. And sure enough, they did. The Japanese sent a boat over. One of our majors went out and met them and talked to them and surrendered Fort Hughes as well. And we were captives. We were in the tunnel, one of the tunnels, when the Japanese came in that night. The ugliest looking soldiers you ever saw. Bow-legged, ugly looking soldiers, little guys. But we knew damn well we better keep our mouths shut, because we had taken our rifles and stood them up and stacked them in a triangle, and we didn't know whether we were going to get killed, massacred, or just what. We were standing along one side of the little tunnel, and they walked in. One guy was carrying a machine gun, and another one was carrying ammunition, and they came in, and we did what they told us to do. And the next day, we were looking for food, looking for water, and we ended up, we were taken over back to Corregidor to a place called 92nd Garage. And we were there for about 13 days until the Japs got a ship ready. They took us over to Manila. Then they paraded us down the main street of Manila and bragging about how good soldiers they were and so on and so forth. And we went along with it. You bet we did. We didn't stick our necks out or do anything we shouldn't do. We ended up at the main hospital there in Manila.
I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes here, Bill, and I'm thinking about it. I mean, you are, at this point, 22 years old. It's May of 1942. You're halfway around the world from all your friends and family. You've had buddies killed, and now you're captured by the Japanese. Where do you find hope in that situation? What did it feel like to not have any idea whether you'd ever be free again?
We just took it day by day.
But little did you know, you were going to have to do that for 1,227 days. Think about that where you're listening right now. That's 3 years, 4 months, and 8 days. That's how long Bill Overmyer spent as a prisoner of the Japanese during World War II. And I'm sorry to do this to you, but we're going to have to wait until next time to hear about what that time in captivity was like, the work that he was forced to do, and of course, those glorious moments that would eventually come. I'll look forward to bringing you the rest of this 94-year-old ex-prisoner of war story. For now, I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.